The clear statement will help it build support and alliances with other countries in the Southeast Asia.
Defining South China Sea boundaries. It's Tuesday, August 4th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, the road to the White House is not as smooth as may be presumed. Getting out the vote, learning from the past, and music for a pandemic. It's all on today's VOA Asia. We continue our look at the South China Sea, a prominent flashpoint of tensions between the United States and China. Today we focus on China's definition of territory, the so-called nine-dash line. Julian Ku, a distinguished professor of constitutional law at Hofstra University School of Law, explains more to VOA's Adriana Zhang. We apologize for the digital echo during the discussion. However, we feel the information is quite interesting.
What's happening is that the U.S. has always encouraged China to abide by the arbitral ruling. It has also said China is bound by the arbitral ruling. But what's new now is the United States has come out and said, and we agree with the actual different parts of the arbitral ruling and will take steps to oppose China's actions, which are in violation of the arbitral ruling, or at least they've suggested they'll take steps. So the difference is saying, not just that we think you should follow whatever the court says, but we agree that what the court said was correct. So that's really the way it's different. And it's something that the United States has not really said clearly until now. And so the United States has never said that it has taken the position that the nine-dash line is illegal. What it said before was that it was very skeptical that there is any legal basis for the nine-dash line and that China should clarify its reasoning. What's happening now is the United States saying, there's no way this could ever be legal no matter what China says. So we reject it.
Are we going to see more concrete action from the U.S.? For example, more sanctions or more military actions towards China?
I don't know. I mean, I think that certainly it lays the groundwork to take more actions. I think what the U.S. has done so far is its actions sort of have always been, we'll take the Navy and the Navy ships will go and it will operate even in places where China says it's within China's control or China's sovereignty or that Chinese rule should be followed. And so they've already been doing that, and I expect they'll continue to do that. And those are the so-called freedom of navigation operations, where the Navy just kind of goes around and just shows that it does not respect China's views on what counts as part of China, I guess. The question is whether they'll do anything more than that, because the Chinese, I think, it doesn't really affect China that much to have the Navy ships go in and out of their waters that they don't, so I think the next step would be something like sanctions. I think is something that's certainly been talked about in Congress and that the president has the authority to do. What I've said is that the United States should treat this like Crimea, which is that Russia is in control of Crimea, but the United States does not accept that Russia has a legal right to control Crimea, and so it will not allow U.S. businesses to operate in Crimea. And at the very least, the United States should adopt a similar approach to the areas that China has built up in the South China Sea that are in violation of the arbitral award. It should not allow U.S. businesses or banks or any other businesses that operate in the United States to do business with or support in any way the construction or the facilities in that region. That would be a small thing, but I think it would be something that we can imagine. I think the bigger picture for the United States is that they want to use this as the clear statement will help it build support and alliances with other countries in the Southeast Asia, because those countries would then be able to come out against China as well and know that the United States is on the same page, and that would encourage them to stand together. So countries like Vietnam, the Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, those countries will know that if they adopt this legal position, they won't be out there on their own. The United States is out there with them. And so this might encourage countries to cooperate and to reject China's legal positions.
Julian Ku, a distinguished professor of constitutional law at Hofstra University School of Law, speaking with VOA's Adriana Zhang. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on VOAnews.com. Australia declares COVID-19 disaster in second largest city. Why U.S. lawmakers introduce bill after bill to help Taiwan. China considers toughening rules for foreign English teachers. Islamic State attack on Afghan prison lasts 20 hours, kills 29. U.S. imposes sanctions on Chinese company over abuse of Uyghurs. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also stop by the VOAnews.com website. As VOA Asia continues, two coronavirus vaccines have entered the final phase of testing. There are now five shots in the pipeline. Scientists expect to know by the end of the year if any of them are safe and effective. VOA's Steve Barragona has this update.
Tests got underway at 120 sites worldwide on a vaccine developed by drug firms BioNTech, Pfizer, and China's Fosun Pharma. Another 89 sites in the United States are hosting tests on Moderna's vaccine. They're the last set of clinical trials before approval. Frank Ader leads the study at a Moderna site in New York.
And once we get past this trial, we can move into the general public and actually mass producing and having this given to the population.
Before that happens, though, these trials will gauge how well the vaccines work and how safe they are. Though new techniques helped get these shots ready in record time, officials say all the normal safety checks are in place. The tests that just started are a key part of that, says Vanderbilt University infectious disease doctor William Schaffner.
These are new technology vaccines against a new virus in humans. We need to be very careful about that and look at vaccine safety very carefully. That information comes out of the large, we call them phase three trials. Those are the ones that are currently underway.
Yeah, go ahead.
Those phase three trials involve tens of thousands of patients to look for less common side effects. Scientists hope for results by the end of the year. Another vaccine in phase three comes from Oxford University and drug firm AstraZeneca. Like the Moderna and BioNTech vaccines, the Oxford shot triggered immune responses in early tests. But that's not enough, says Oxford's project lead, Sarah Gilbert.
So we don't know how strong that immune response needs to be. So we can't say just by looking at the immune responses whether this is going to protect people or not. And the only way we're going to find out is by doing the large phase three trials.
Even before those trials produce results, the British government has given companies millions of dollars and the U.S. government billions to manufacture the vaccines. That way, some doses will be ready right away if results are positive. Sandy Douglas is with the Oxford team.
Vaccine may be available for people in some high-risk groups in the UK by the end of the year, but it won't be made available to everybody immediately. It's likely to be given to the people who have the most to benefit from it, the most to gain from it earliest, and then gradually introduced for other people.
U.S. health officials are also discussing who will get the limited supply of first doses, likely beginning with healthcare workers. Two Chinese companies have vaccines in phase three testing in the United Arab Emirates and Brazil. At least 17 other vaccines are in earlier clinical tests around the world. Experts say more is better because different vaccines may work best for different groups of people. Steve Barragona, VOA News.
Happening now in Asia, U.S. President Donald Trump has agreed to give China's internet giant ByteDance 45 days to negotiate the sale of popular video app TikTok to Microsoft Corporation, according to people familiar with the matter. He initially vowed to ban the app altogether. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. With the U.S. presidential election fewer than 100 days away, opinion polls give presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden a double-digit lead over President Trump, whose approval ratings have dropped as U.S. coronavirus deaths continue to rise. However, as VOA's Brian Patton reports, the presidential race could still tighten as it becomes less a referendum on the president and more a choice between him and Biden, whose record and proposals will receive more scrutiny when he officially becomes his party's nominee.
President Trump's approval ratings have dropped during the prolonged coronavirus pandemic in the United States, a deep economic recession, and civil unrest. Presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden, who was President Barack Obama's vice president, is now leading in presidential election polls by double digits. His rise is due in large part to a low-key and disciplined campaign that has relentlessly criticized Trump's handling of the crisis and slammed Trump's erratic messaging, including denying responsibility for how America handles the pandemic.
He's shown that he can't beat the pandemic and keep you safe. He can't turn the economy around and get America back to work.
Despite bleak polling data, Trump's backers say if the U.S. can slow the coronavirus infection rate or develop an effective vaccine before the November election, the president's prospects will improve.
The more the focus remains on the pandemic, the better shape Biden's in. So any issue or combination of issues that move the focus away from the pandemic is probably going to hurt Biden by helping Trump.
The president's supporters also see opportunity as protests for racial justice have been marred by violence, arguing Trump's law and order message will resonate as unrest continues in several American cities. Biden, for his part, has been careful not to endorse protesters' calls to disband or defund police forces. A political moderate, Biden has nonetheless put forward expansive and expensive economic, environmental, and health care plans Republicans will attack as job-killing and socialist, hoping to appeal to pro-business, independent voters. At the same time, the president's strong opposition to abortion, gun control, and illegal immigration is likely to keep enthusiasm high among his base supporters. Biden's choice of a female vice presidential running mate expected in coming days will appeal to core Democratic constituencies, but could also alienate moderates if seen as too progressive and divide the party if not seen as progressive enough. For the 77-year-old Biden, who is known for making verbal gaffes, the upcoming presidential debates present a potential hazard. But supporters say Biden will be prepared for attacks from Trump.
He knows what his focus is. It's the economy. It's health care. It's the pandemic. And when he comes into a debate situation, that's exactly what he's going to focus on.
Many 2016 polls incorrectly predicted Trump would lose to then-Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton. Democratic and Republican strategists agree current polls in no way guarantee a Biden victory in November. Brian Patton, VOA News, Washington.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
This news from VOA Asia. Researchers at the National University of Singapore have developed an artificial intelligence device with a sense of touch that can identify objects and textures. You can see this story at VOA 60. Also follow us at VOA Asia Facebook and Twitter. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hundreds of companies in the United States are using a variety of methods to get Americans to vote in November's presidential election. Many are giving their workers paid time off on Election Day, while others are helping people register to vote, offering reduced fares for transportation to polling stations, or helping to feed them once they're there. VOA's Julie Tabo has more from the spokesman of a company with employees worldwide and a political expert who says these incentives could have a significant impact on voter turnout.
Americans need to get out and vote. That's the message from hundreds of CEOs across the country who have pledged to support their employees' constitutional right to cast a ballot. Workers shouldn't have to choose between earning a paycheck and voting, says J.J. Huggins, a spokesman for Patagonia, a global outdoor clothing and equipment company with about 2,000 employees in the United States. Patagonia's CEO gave all its employees a paid day off on Election Day in 2016.
By doing that, she was telling the Patagonia workforce that on Election Day, nothing is more important than getting out there and casting your ballot.
Patagonia, which describes itself as an activist company, is co-founder of Time to Vote, a nonpartisan movement led by nearly 600 businesses with the goal of increasing voter participation in the U.S.
I mentioned Walmart. We also have Target, Best Buy, Visa, Deloitte, JP Morgan Chase, Twitter, Uber, Lyft. You think of these companies and how many people they employ and the range of from blue collar to white collar, we're going to have a far larger impact.
Such company involvement is crucial, given that 35% of voters have cited scheduling conflicts with work as a primary factor that keeps them from the polls. U.S. elections are traditionally held on a Tuesday, a normal workday.
There's a real role that companies can play in this moment to give their workers the space and opportunity to vote, as well as to leverage their brands and platforms to create a culture of civic participation.
Vote.org works with companies like Patagonia to implement vote-friendly policies and practices.
That's a combination of removing work-related barriers, but also proactively providing voting information and resources to their employees.
In June, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg said his company will be helping 4 million people register to vote.
And that includes information on voter registration, voting by mail, and early voting.
And Uber recently announced that in addition to giving its salaried employees the day off on Election Day, it's providing resources on the Uber and Uber Eats platforms to help people register to vote and get to the polls, and plans to feed people in line. The sheer number of companies that are encouraging and enabling Americans to vote is unprecedented, says Gilbert, and she'd like to see more.
We'd love to see the 100 million people that sat out in the last election show up to vote this year, and figuring out ways that we can systematically tackle and dismantle and remove any of those barriers is critical work that we want to see done in the next 100 days.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
How to stay healthy. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses.
Now on VOA Asia, there has been much controversy in the United States over the removing of Confederate and other monuments that celebrate figures with a racist past. Russia offers a cautionary warning about the perils of dismantling history too fast. Charles Maines has more for us from Moscow.
In August 1991, thousands of people gathered outside the Russian White House in central Moscow. Communist hardliners had just launched a coup, a last-ditch attempt to stop democratic reforms embodied by Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev's perestroika. The public rallied behind Boris Yeltsin, both an ally and rival of Gorbachev's, who led a successful revolt against the coup plotters and ultimately the USSR. But for many, the symbolic end of the Soviet Union came on a square outside the KGB headquarters in Moscow. The removal of Iron Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of the Soviet secret police, signaled a stark break with the violence and repression of the past. Only this wasn't just the will of the crowd. Amid concern someone might get hurt trying to topple the statue, Moscow's first freely elected government arranged for Dzerzhinsky's removal following a late-night vote.
No, he wasn't torn down. We raised him off his pedestal using two cranes because he was so heavy you needed to, and we lowered him down on a platform.
Felix ultimately ended up here, a park in central Moscow that's become an outdoor museum to discarded Soviet relics. A place to reflect on the darker chapters of Soviet life and perhaps how much the new Russia has changed.
Monuments are something by nature always in the wrong place, because at some point they're put up and they stand there. But time keeps moving forward.
Today, Bolshevik leader Vladimir Lenin still dots the landscape, ignored by most. But polls show growing admiration for Soviet leader Joseph Stalin, and Russia's security services are again a powerful force in Vladimir Putin's Russia. Throughout, Dzerzhinsky has remained in the park, a fact that those who helped bring him here say is due to having preserved the monument while putting his legacy in context.
You can't allow these monuments to be desecrated because it provokes a desire for revenge, to return them back. That's the price of desecration, and thankfully we avoided it.
It's a message something may prove helpful to Western societies as they grapple with monuments to their own complex histories, deciding who deserves a pedestal and who should be put away forever. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
With concerts, festivals, tours, and award shows all around the world canceled or put on indefinite hold, many professional musicians and composers who had relied on performances for their income have found themselves in a difficult situation. But some say that these challenges present the opportunities to grow. We hear more from Maria Prus.
A fiery mix of bluegrass, Irish folk and rock music brought by a DC-based band Scythian has been entertaining a Facebook crowd live twice a month. What started as a smartphone webcast in March evolved into a full-scale, multi-camera, professional-sounding performance called Warren Stream.
Every stream will have between 15 and 20 festivals and music venues partnering and cross-posting with us. And so we've been averaging about 50,000 views per stream. I mean, we don't get paid for those views, but we ask people for Venmo tips or like PayPal, and the people have been incredibly generous. So that's how we've been surviving till now.
Not only did Scythian largely depend on the festivals, they were planning their 6th annual Bluegrass Festival in Virginia Mountains that attracted over 8,000 people last year.
Entertainment has always been recession-proof. So our band has survived two recessions. When people are doing poorly in recessions, they want to go out and forget. And we're excited about this year, and then all of a sudden, yeah, it's probably not going to happen. But I think if we can keep on growing our fan base with the Corn Streams, then when we go back to doing the festival, more people are going to know about us than ever before.
Andrew Krause, a Maryland-based concert pianist, has also started his Facebook classical music series called Respite. He says he has always advised his students to look for sources of additional income, but it's up to the audience whether or not to support his work online.
If you want artists to be able to produce content, you have to support us. Because if we are working 18 hours a day at something else, then we don't have the energy, time, and ultimately the expertise to produce anything for you that you're really going to want to listen to. It will truly become the age of the amateur.
Meanwhile, Krause advises musicians to keep their hopes up and teach online.
A little bit different, but you can learn to use that technology and make it work for you. And this is a great time for it. I mean, it's summer. The kids are out of school. They can't go anywhere much. So this would be the time to go and advertise.
Teaching is something New York City-based opera singer Antonina Chekhovska is focusing on now.
Really build a studio and sort of start my own brand, because I'm also at a place where I know what I'm doing. Like I'm not world famous, but I know what I'm doing. I'm singing.
Musicians agree that if the industry survives, it's going to come out of the pandemic looking very different. And musicians will no doubt be able to develop a whole new creative approach. Maria Prus in Washington, VOA News.
That's our program. You can hear VOA Asia every weekday at the same time. And you can find us online at voanews.com, where you can download our full-length 25-minute programs and listen to them as a podcast. We thank you as always for joining us, and we thank those who helped bring this program to you. our managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, and Keith Lane. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead. Be safe. Be well.